Buy now and make no payments until fall. That's right. At Jeff Weiler's Columbus Auto Mall, drive today with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. Whether it's a car, truck, or SUV, why wait? Shop hundreds of vehicles, all with no payments till fall. Hurry into the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall, where the deals won't wait and neither should you. Find us on Gender Road or jeffweilercolumbusautomall.com.
I'm sorry about your daughter, Joel.
I'm sorry about your daughter, Joel.
But I have lost people, too.
You have no idea what loss is.
Everyone I have cared for has either died or left me.
Everybody fucking except for you. Don't tell me that I would be safer with someone else, because the truth is, I would just be more scared.
Beware, spoiler phobes! You have stumbled into A Storm of Spoilers, a podcast currently covering The Last of Us Season 2 and split into two sections. The first section of the podcast we call The Calm, where we can only talk about things that happened on the series up to Season 2, Episode 4, titled Day 1. The second section of the podcast we call The Storm, as in A Storm of Spoilers, where we talk about adaptation changes from The Last of Us Part 2, The Game, and speculate on what we might see in the remaining episodes of this season and beyond. We're not ruining, we're enriching, and we're not infected yet. Hi, hello, I'm Dave Gonzalez.
And I'm Neil Miller, and welcome back to A Storm of Spoilers. Very excited talk to you about episode 4, season 2 of The Last of Us. But before we get to that, I've got some housekeeping, as always. Our upcoming schedule, of course, we have some more episodes of The Last of Us to talk about. There are 7 in this season, and we're going to cover them all. Episodes drop every Wednesday. Hopefully that's when you're listening to this. If not, that's chill too. Whenever you want to listen to it, it's fine. Whatever. Also, if you're interested in getting more Stormy, you can join me on Monday evenings, twitch.tv/Neilstradamus, that is NEILSTRADOMUS, where I am streaming The Last of Us Part 2 Remastered, the video game. We are way ahead of the show at this point, but we are getting some stuff that is incredibly relevant to what we're going to talk about today, but we'll save that for the storm. So join me on Twitch Monday evening, 8 o'clock Central. Been having a really good time with that. Good, of course, being a relative term, because shit gets dark in this game. And I imagine the TV show is going to follow suit, but we will get to that. In the meantime, if you'd like more from Dave and I, you can join us, of course, at patreon.com/DaveandNeil. That's DaveAndNeil for more content, of course, more behind extra bonus content from the previous projects in this feed, like our Game of Thrones years, the Lost rewatch. You can also get stuff that Dave and I have done since then, like our Twin Peaks rewatch project. We're currently going through The Leftovers for our members at the $10 or more level. That has been quite a lot of fun. That actually synced up with The Last of Us this week with Take On Me. Both The Leftovers and The Last of Us had big Take On Me scenes. We're feeling pretty in sync this week. So that was fun for folks who are in both places. And of course, you get weekly pop culture adventure episodes where Dave and I talk about movies we're watching, video games we're playing, and do some deep dives into great cinema. This month we're doing May of the Dead, part 4. This is very fun. We're talking about movies where death is defeated, as is not happening here on The Last of Us.
Like The Crow, which we'll be watching this week.
Like The Crow. It's going to be fun. And of course, you get access to our wonderful Slack community that is one of the coolest and least toxic places on the internet that you can be. Much better than the social media platforms that exist. And as far as I know, nobody in there is AI. Also, huge benefit. So join us on the Patreon. It's pretty awesome. All right, enough shilling for our other stuff. Let's talk about how you can get in touch with this podcast. You can always send us a raven, stormofspoilers@gmail.com. Some of you have this week. Can't wait to read those. We will get there. You can also, if you'd like to help us out, review us on iTunes or Spotify. We appreciate if you leave us a 5-star rating. You can say whatever you want. Dave, unfortunately, no new reviews this week. Everybody's gave us either spent their reviews, or maybe they were a little busy this week. I understand. you know, people have lives. But listen, if you got a couple of minutes and you're enjoying what we do, go into your Apple Podcasts app, hit us with a 5-star review, say a few nice words. We would greatly appreciate it. That actually is sort of like the number one way, other than like sharing our content with your friends. That is the number one way to help other people see this pod and get it out there to the masses, who I'm sure are just dying for more Last of Us discourse at this point. All right. I promised that some people sent ravens. I have some ravens. The first one comes from Kevin, and it is about the video game. Kevin, I shortened this a little bit, but discussed having not really played the having waited until after the first season to play the first game, and then says, I figured I'd jump right into part two after that. But my surprising dilemma now is that I was actually kind of mixed on the gameplay in part one. I found that some of the controls and movement kind of frustrating and was kind of baffled by a lot of the human AI behavior, and also had some weird ludonarrative dissonance where it felt really strange to murder like 300 plus humans in an otherwise lonely post-apocalyptic world called The Last of Us. Maybe that's kind of on me for my own gameplay decisions, though. Who's the real monster here? With part two being split over two seasons, I feel like I don't want to just wait, but I'm struggling to decide if I want to just bite the bullet, play part two, and hope that I can have a better time, maybe try a slightly less murdery gameplay style, or if I should watch other people, possibly Neil, play it. And if so, do I watch a full gameplay, full playthrough, or a condensed one? Or should I just stop caring and listen to the spoiler sections of podcasts? I'm seeing a good amount of chatter on Reddit that a lot of people do think the gameplay is a lot better in part two. I'll probably end up just playing it between seasons two and three and catching up, but I'm finding myself a little overwhelmed by the number of different choices I have. Any advice? So Kevin, of course, seeking our advice as to how to properly consume, especially if you're spoiler curious, the vast source material available for this show. I mean, selfishly, I want to be like, yeah, you should watch me Monday nights on Twitch.
Boy, do I have a solution for you.
Boy, do I have a solution for you, Kevin. But I will say, folks, the thing that you're hearing about the gameplay being a little bit better in part two is correct. I think part two is a far superior game. Although, here's what I will say, and this is something that I think is already evident in season two. If one of your concerns was about the ludonarrative dissonance, a real term that I just learned today from this email that I think is fantastic. It's a video game term that was coined by someone named Clint Hocking in 2007 that refers to the intersection of the video game's ludic elements, the gameplay, and the narrative elements. I think it was referring to like BioShock and like the game sort of forcing you to do maybe things that are objectively bad morally, right, or ethically, but it kind of requires you to do them in order to progress in the game or get the most out of the game, or if you're a completist, get all the coins or loot in the game. If your concern was having to kill more humans than infected, you can kind of see how Ellie and Dina have already come up against more human opponents, even in the show. And that is magnified exponentially in the game. So like we've already come up against now two different factions of human, groups here in Seattle that are going to be combative at the very least toward these interlopers, Ellie and Dina. So there is quite a bit more murdering of the humans. Also, we haven't seen this in the show yet, but we've talked about this multiple times, I think, in the calm, Dave, about my distaste for the way this game forces me to kill animals,
yes.
Specifically dogs. And I'm glad that the show is sort of leaving that out, at least so far. But the second game, especially early on, really amps that up. A lot of these WLF patrols have dogs. There's just no way to, like, you can't. There's no option to like toss a piece of beef jerky over a fence and have the dog run away. Like, you have to deal with the dog. So I guess we're very spoiler positive here on this podcast, obviously. So the easiest way is just listen into the storm. We'll tell you everything you need to know. I would say if you're going to watch a playthrough, a full playthrough is the best, because it's not a very long game. I think it's at most like a 25-hour experience. But I think that everything in the game, the second game's narrative, is extremely important. And I think that they are adapting it pretty close so far. So I think it's all going to be very relevant for the show. So if you're going to, I would either play it yourself or watch a full playthrough. I wouldn't watch a condensed playthrough of Last of Us Season 2 or Part 2. Sorry. So I don't know.
I watched a full playthrough when the game came out. I waited, obviously, a little bit for people to actually upload those full playthroughs. But it was very interesting to watch. And I did skip some gameplay parts towards the back end of it. But I had a fine experience with it. Which isn't to say it's the, you know, nominal way to play through adventure games if you like adventure games. But at the time, I didn't know that about myself, Neil. So I just wanted to hear what everybody was talking about. Sure.
Yeah, that makes sense. All right. So hopefully that's an answer, and hopefully we'll see you in the storm there, Kevin. Second Raven. This is a good way to kick off the calm this week. This one comes from Maddie, who says, as a non-game player, I echo the sentiments of Dina. What the fuck is wrong with Seattle? Is there any way to provide a brief summary, or is that something you expect to be explored in the remaining episodes? I would say yes to the second question. I do definitely. We've already gotten more backstory about Seattle than the game gives us, especially early on. So I feel like we're going to get quite a lot more of an exploration of what is going on here. But I feel like it's pretty straightforward, Dave. Fedra, which we saw in season one, was in control of Boston, was in control of Seattle at one point. And they weren't doing such a good job. They were, obviously, as this opening scene in this episode illustrates, they took everybody's rights away. People weren't happy about it. And multiple factions sprung up out of the people that lived in Seattle. And it caused this conflict where, I think it's very interesting, the scene where Ellie and Dina find the tank and Ellie makes the comment like, oh, these people were all fighting each other and they all had Fedra uniforms on. So it's like at a certain point, Fedra broke up into multiple factions. It doesn't seem like Fedra's around anymore. It seems like the WLF and the Seraphites are the only two left. And as we learned this week, both of them are very vicious. So, last week, if you would ask us last week at the end of the episode, like, is one of them the predator and one of them the prey? We could have said, sure, it looks like the wolves are hunting the Seraphites. But this week we get it going in the other direction. So, yeah, we have multiple factions.
Well, we finally get
factions.
To call them Seraphites in the calm this week.
Yes.
We had to go full scars, even though, as we learned this week and as we learned in the game, they don't like to be called that.
They really don't.
We got some a little bit more filling us out. And then, Neil, while we're here, this might be a good time to transition a little bit into the beginning of the show, because we have this character that Isaac meets up with, shakes her hand even, Hanrahan. Is this a video game character?
I don't think so. I think this is a new character. This Alana Eubanks character who...
Yes.
It seems like she's going to have a slightly larger role. According to the next week on, she's got some more speaking, more lines of dialogue.
More things to do.
I don't recognize her as an important character. Like, she might be, she may exist in the game. Like, and that's kind of the fun thing. Like, I was listening to the behind the scenes official podcast that Troy Baker is hosting, which is excellent, by the way. And they talked about this opening sequence and what Isaac does. And there actually is this sort of situation exists in the game. Like, there are notes that you find in the environment in Seattle. And then there's also like a Fedra truck with burned bodies inside of it that you find that sort of lead, you could piece together like that something like this happened, like a Fedra officer burned his own dudes and then defected, essentially. I mean, wasn't necessarily Isaac in the game, but I like that they sort of, that Craig Mazin sort of pieced this together from little bits of environmental storytelling in the game. So it's like, I, you know, Hanrahan could be a name from the game, but I don't remember her being an actual character. So
it was just good to see that, you know, we got maybe another player here, sure. Because Isaac, as we spoke about previously, Jeffrey Wright played that character in the game. So he's exploring more of a character he's already sort of inhabited. I am all for complexities. I love your summation of it, and I think that is accurate, but I also love sort of what you're talking about Craig Mazin's doing, which is trying to bring some of the environmental hints in Seattle maybe into the show in more direct ways, which is good. I think the more we can complicate these things, the better. Although I do think that this is the first episode where I was a little puzzled overall by the tone. Let's talk about it, Neil.
Sure.
Maybe it's because I like the idea of a ludonarrative dissonance maybe applying a little bit to this episode, because I saw a lot of mixed reactions to this episode online since it aired. And I think a lot of it is accusing it of being uneven writing, because it seems like, to me, and this is where you have to help me out, there's a certain immediacy to Ellie being angry on this revenge kick that the game has, because she leaves immediately after seeing Joel die, rather than the 3-month period that we have in the show. And you are inhabiting her while you are, I'm guessing, constantly in fear for the most part, and keeping sort of yourself on edge. So I saw a lot of people react to Ellie. So Ellie and Dina this week sort of being a little bit too relaxed for the things that they're getting into, which, to be fair, I guess I could sort of feel that. The reason I'm not going to like put it up against the show as a negative thing is I think this is a result of episodic television, which means you're going to have episodes where we just have to do other things, and it's not going to behoove us to necessarily be sad about Joel all the time. I'm sure we'll get back to being sad about Joel. They definitely name dropped him at the end of the Take On Me sequence, just so we remembered why we were there. And two, I think it is like a little bit of a ludonarrative thing. We, as a group of people watching dramatic scenes, will never have to plug into it and suddenly be Ellie the way that the game makes you do so. So I think ultimately the reason that I'm going to come down on the positive side, or with the people who came down positively on this episode, is I think it has a lot of great chemistry between Isabella Merced and Bella Ramsey portraying the evolution in their relationship that I was already prepared for, because you told me sort of that their relationship was in a different place in the game than where it necessarily was this week on television. What did you think about that sort of ending coupling? It really worked for me, but in terms of, you and I watch a lot of TV, so I'm trying to figure out how to put it into words why it worked for me. The idea of two characters in a heightened situation, they suddenly diffuse that situation. They're not going to turn into a cordyceps zombie because they're immune/pregnant. Turning into a sex scene didn't play weird for me, but it does play weird for some people. What did you think about the core relationship in this episode?
Sure. Well, and I think, you know, it now makes a lot more sense to me why I referred to it in the storm a couple of weeks ago as they're like slow rolling the relationship. Right. And I think that felt like a function of TV, and it was like, okay, maybe they're waiting for something. They're waiting for a slightly bigger moment for these characters to realize that they are into each other. Right. And I like the pairing of the Take On Me scene with Dina sort of realizing her feelings for Ellie. And then, you know, we then get this moment of extreme tension that leads to them revealing their secrets. And I also, you know, as far as like the pacing of it, it does feel like a function of being episodic TV because, you know, the TV show has to stop every hour. And there is this element in the game, especially when you're in Seattle playing as Ellie, where the game's goal is very different. The game's goal is to keep you playing as long as possible. And the game knows that it can lock you in and keep throwing action at you. And you can just sit there and play for like five straight hours, right? And never let go of the story until you get the answers that you're looking for. The TV show does not have that luxury, you know? And so that it has to have rising action. It has to have slower moments. It has to have, you know, sort of a wide range of vibes in every single episode in order to keep the entirety of the audience engaged with it. So I wouldn't go in expecting it to have the same relentless pace, especially to some of the action that the game has, because the game is like, it's trying to lock you in to Ellie's story. And it does. When you get to Seattle, it's just like bang, 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 you know, several things in a row where you're just constantly under threat. And it's it feels like, you know, you get so wrapped up, and that's how you get so wrapped up in sort of Ellie's anger and Ellie's revenge. And I think that's where we could create that's what could create this sort of disconnect, where it doesn't seem like TV show Ellie is maybe as mad, but I have a feeling she'll get there. Let's give her some time. She's still pretty pissed about what Abby did to Joel, right? Like, if she wasn't mad, they would have gone home already, right? Because they've already seen some terrible stuff. And now she knows that Dina is pregnant. Like, that is that's a huge piece of knowledge for her to have. That is a huge reason for Ellie to consider giving up this quest, right? Like, why would she, if this situation continues to get worse and more dangerous, which we assume it will, wouldn't Ellie then seriously consider getting Dina out of there? And, you know, now that she's very happy that she's about to be a dad, would she not want to protect Dina and the unborn child as much as she can, rather than lead them further into what is a pretty fucked up situation in Seattle?
Yeah, definitely. I also love that dad line. I've been seeing a lot of people hold it up as like bad writing, but for me, it's just a weird misreading of like a confluence of themes that the show is trying to put upon you. One, 19-year-old lesbians are always weird. I say that from personal experience, from being friends with some 19-year-old lesbians in my life when I was of their age. And I don't think I don't think that much has changed in the year since I've been 19. Two, this is a show about sort of like father figures adopting daughter figures. I don't think gender necessarily needs to be with that. That's why we call them father figures. So I believe like that's also there. And the fact that Ellie loves what I would call dad jokes puts that also squarely in it. So it's a big overlap for me. I did see some people being like, what a way to like treat Jesse. And like, I could understand if maybe Jesse was in the room, but like, nobody's really thinking about Jesse's feelings in that theater in Seattle on day one. That's just not the way, I don't know, drama works for me. I'm going to try not to get mad at the internet, because for the most part, I think people are taking on this show with you should be able to have complex emotions for a show that is elevated zombie drama, especially when we get to a location like Seattle that has a very violent human-on-human conflict that we don't know that much about. And, of course, a subway full of cordyceps. Not exactly the cordyceps I was expecting. given our storm conversation last week, but maybe we'll pick that up in the storm this week. I do want to talk, Neil, about some stuff. First of all, the Apollo 11 reference.
Apollo 1.
Yeah. Thank you. Well, also Apollo 11 reference, because she sort of mixes them up where she's like, Apollo 1 was supposed to be the first one to go to the moon.
Yeah.
The Apollo program was supposed to go to the moon. Apollo 1 was just supposed to go up into space prove that the new three-person space capsule worked. I always enjoy space references because I was one of those kids. I went to space camp. We did not accidentally get launched into space like the movie Space Camp, but I do think about the Apollo 1 astronauts occasionally. So it was great to see that. I definitely know more about the Apollo 1 astronauts than I know about a tank. The streets of Seattle, where I understand, having done some quick research after this episode, that they actually filmed, I believe, in the City Hall district of Seattle, which I saw non-ironically called the Gayberhood. So it was great to see some of the flags, some of the pride, and also just a reminder that these girls were raised in a post-apocalyptic world where they don't actually know where that symbolism from our time came about. What do you think about Seattle so far, as it's been portrayed in the show so far?
I mean, I think production design wise, they're doing a really fantastic job. You know, this reads very similarly to the environment in the game of Seattle being this sort of overgrown way. Like, it looks, the way Seattle reads is as a city that has been destroyed and alone and very lightly inhabited for a while, right? Whereas, you know, Boston, there still seems to, you know, there wasn't as much vegetation in a city like Boston, mm-hmm. right? And it seems a little bit more dusty, I guess. You know, and this might be a function of budget as well for the TV show. But I think that in Seattle, we're getting more greenery. We're getting more of nature sort of taking back the city. And we're getting to see that it's, you know, it's a lot quieter, and in a way that is deeply disconcerting, because it seems like things went very poorly for Fedra very quickly, at least, or, you know, I guess 11 years ago at this point. So what's that? That's about halfway since the outbreak, right? Because it's been, what, 20 some years? No, it's been longer than that at this point.
What year is it in the show?
It's supposed to be like 2029 in the show.
Yeah, and the outbreak was 03.
Yeah, so it's been 11 years since Isaac's, since he defected from Fedra. So Fedra was, I guess, there for 15, 20 years, and then it all went shit. So,
yeah, a lot of bodies are full skeletons at this point.
That's true.
That's the way that I could tell how we're working here, through time. But luckily they decide, they see what I guess wrongly thought was the Space Needle, but is the television station, from last week, with WLF painted on the dish, and then they decide to hide and not approach it on horseback in the dark. And so they go into a music shop where they shelter Shimmer. Neil, is Shimmer still in that music shop by the end of the episode?
I have to assume so. Shimmer remains safe and alive, and seems to have some indoor grass patches to eat. Mm-hmm. Shimmer living his best life, as far as we can tell.
And then Ellie finds the guitar with the silica packets to keep it free from moisture, which is something that I
really
definitely learned about taking care of musical instruments the hard way when my bass neck warped when I traveled to New York for the first time.
Just a fantastic silica packets joke that I did not see coming.
Well, it's great. And then she takes it out, and then she tunes it, and then she plays Take On Me, and what a scene. I assume it's directly out of the video game, because I vaguely remember that in the video game.
Directly.
And it's it's lit, that place where she sits, it's lit like a come sit here in the video game, where it's like there's a pillar of light right down to a little box. And I played enough adventure games now to know that means I'm supposed to go over there and look at it.
What's wild too, Dave, is that, you know, and they brought this up on the official podcast, is that that is actually a very missable scene in the game, right? Like, you get to Seattle, it's day one, you're I believe you're going to the courthouse, which is like right next door to the music center, and you're looking for gasoline so that you can get one of these gates open. There's like a series of gates that you have to get open in order to like get into Seattle in the game. And I luckily am a loot goblin. So I go any, especially in a game like The Last of Us, any building that it looks like I can go into, I'm going in, even if I'm pretty sure there's going to be infected in there and I'm going to have to fight them. That also means there's loot in there. So I ended up in the music store and was able to get this scene the first time around. But I can only imagine that'd be so tough getting all the way through the game and then finding out that you missed like one of the best scenes in the game, which is Ellie do it. Because Ashley Johnson in the game, her rendition is fantastic. Bella Ramsey, who can very much play the guitar in real life, also just crushes it. It's the perfect Ellie song, apparently.
Who knew? Actually, it makes more lyrical sense here in The Last of Us than it did for you and I think earlier with The Leftovers. But I do really appreciate it. I once again appreciate the chemistry between these two actors in this moment, in having to sell, as you were saying, Dina's emotional switch. And then all the interviews, post-episode interviews I've seen with Isabella Merced says that, you know, it was incredibly easy to act that, which I think means she's just a good actor. But really love it. Then she sets the guitar down in the sunbeam and they leave. And I'm like, did you learn nothing from the silica packets?
Yeah, I mean, it feels a little on the nose. She like leaves the guitar in the exact position where the guitar is in the game. But, you know, you got to let them do a little bit of that visual.
Got to let them do some game merit. Easter eggs.
Got to let them hit the one perfect shot every once in a while, you know?
Well, she just ruined Seattle's last guitar, so
it's true. Although,
good job, Ellie.
Do we think that's Seattle's last guitar? I don't know.
Oh,
there's a lot of guitars in Seattle.
Does the WLF have campfires where they celebrate team building?
Maybe they got a lot of people.
I would love to find out. And then we move eventually to the television station, but not after cutting to check up on what Isaac's doing 11 years after our opening flashback for some good old torture. If you thought this was a Walking Dead type show, you might be right, because here is torture after a pretty excellent monologue about cookware. Neil, have you ever cooked a meal to impress a date?
Yes, I have. I'm not a very good cook, but I am aware of its power.
Yes.
As a man, you know, if you can do even the smallest amount of cooking, gentlemen, this is very powerful for the dating experience, because, you know, not everybody can do it. Not everybody's willing to try it. It's kind of like dancing in that way. Right. Like, yes. Women love a guy who can dance. Women also like a guy who will try to dance, even if he's not that good at it. So sometimes it's about the effort. And I think this is a great, great monologue. Obviously, it's great to see Jeffrey Wright in this role. I think what's wild about it, especially playing the game this week and seeing Isaac on screen, is that the Isaac of the game doesn't quite look like Jeffrey Wright. I mean, he obviously is voiced by Jeffrey Wright, but it's kind of wild. He just, how the character design is a little bit off of Jeffrey Wright, but he's so great in this role. And I think it's a great way of reminding, in both of the Isaac scenes that we get this week, sort of showing the separation between the characters who remember the world before and the characters who exist only in the world after. Right.
Right.
Josh Peck's character. Shout out to Josh Peck for fun cameo. The Whackness is Josh Peck. Like, clearly only has context for the world after the outbreak. And then we get this story from Isaac about something that is probably completely foreign to this young man, young Seraphite man, who I don't think was alive before the outbreak. He looks relatively young. So, you know, it's this interesting humanizing moment that he was just like a normal dude who was just trying to date. And then there was this outbreak, and now he's the torture happy, or at least torture proficient leader of these militant group. And he's very scary.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's interesting how the show lays out the events where we see him flip on Fedra, and we kind of get it because, as you were saying, Josh Peck has a whole Greenberg story, mm-hmm. and they're all the Greenbergs because they're all idiots. So watching them get grenaded didn't feel that bad. Then we have a torture scene, and it's like, oh, those are the guys they slaughtered, and now they're torturing them. That seems bad. And then we finally get to the TV station, where we see how the Seraphites deal with their adversaries with some actual hanging extras with exterior makeup effects applied to them to look like they'd be disemboweled. But imagine being an extra that day, The Last of Us, and getting to hang there in a harness, but not looking like you're in a harness while they get all these shots. That's a fantastic HBO moment, but it does also sort of make you reevaluate the entire time by giving Isaac, I think, the most forward face of the wolves outside of Abby and her crew at this point. I sort of don't know how to feel about it. Every scene's been complicating how I feel, especially that back and forth with the Seraphite that he has, where they talk about sort of like the endless breaking of treaties, which sounds very familiar to current international politics, mm-hmm. and sort of like the cycle of violence with the show is trying to talk about all of that coming together. But then also just like, even after Isaac's monologue and the burning and his position of power, he kind of loses the battle of the wills in that interrogation when the Seraphite puts out his other hand unprompted, and Isaac realizes he's not going to get anything out of that guy. So it is complicated, it is violent, it is graphic, which is, I think, a pretty good place to put the show right before its sort of protracted two-location action scene kicks off once they get to the TV station. Once the wolves get to the TV station, mm-hmm. and Ellie and Dina are there, that is probably the most video game coded series of events for me, where you're like literally hiding behind boxes as these wolves with flashlights are like sweeping the room when you're trying to crouch and sneak behind other boxes and get out of the room.
Oh, 100%.
Is that how it plays out in the game?
Yeah. Well, first of all, the visual of the people hanging is sort of an iconic one in a similarly like round studio in the TV station. It's set up a little bit differently because there's like a second level to it in the game that you have to deal with. But that's just because, you know, you got to have more to do as the player in the game. but I think that's it still works. And I think it's hugely important because, again, the show set up the Seraphites last week as sort of the prey of the wolves, right? They were trying to escape the war. They were trying to, just get their children to a peaceful place. And then, we learn very quickly in this episode, Isaac's like, you guys are just have bows and arrows. Like we're going to win this thing. And, very immediately, we discover that they are very formidable and are unafraid to do things to, I guess, intimidate their opponent, right? And dehumanize their opponent in so many ways by not only leaving them there, but like getting the studio lighting on them, you know, like,
well, I guess that's a question.
Super
I
intense
have.
Performance art piece they got going on.
And that's a question I have on how I read them getting into the TV station. Ellie maps out, you know, sort of shimming up that pole and getting in through the window, and seems kind of incredulous. A, that somebody would want to do that, and B, why somebody would want to do that. I guess by like hunting the wolf, she doesn't know there's another faction out there mm-hmm. yet. She just thinks that there's just infected.
Yeah.
Or was it that was somebody's escape route and she's taking it completely the opposite? She just only sees it as an entrance route.
Yeah, I mean, that might have been how the Scars left the building after they did what they did. Either way, you know, I think this Ellie and Dina seeing this is just as important for them as characters to have this information as it is for us, the audience. And I think you make a good point, this being a very video game coded sequence, not just because there's a lot of sneaking around and hiding behind boxes, which is huge element in the game, but also because like they run into a locked door, like a locked uh-huh. gate door, which is a huge thing in the game. Then they have to crawl through a narrow passage, and then eventually, like later after the encounter in the subway, they run into the most important and frustrating thing to come straight out of the game, one of those big metal turnstiles. It's just like there's a million of those in the second game. So it's funny because, you know, we just as much as I think we should praise them for executing a direct adaptation of the Take on Me scene, which is excellent. There's also so many of these, you know, visual elements peppered in there that once again, I think just show that Craig Mazin is a legit fan of these video games. Like this is not a show made by somebody who has watched a playthrough. This is made by somebody who has played these games multiple times deeply. Like he gets that, you know, running into one of those locked fence doors is absolutely something that triggers the game players because you do it so many times in the game.
Yeah. And then also it seems kind of video gamey. You were talking about in the storm, this subway sequence that we finally got to see on today's episode, and how like the easiest thing kind of to do is to throw a bottle, let mm-hmm. the cordyceps deal with the wolf. And that's sort of what happens here, where the flare touches some sensors on the ground and brings the horde. Is it similar to the game in that it feel like it could be, because the whole idea of going into the subway cars, moving through some subway cars, and then coming back out of the subway cars feels also vaguely video game coded.
Yeah.
But also it seems like if it wasn't a video game and there was a horde, you would just die. Yeah. Like it seems like
if you're
in the subways as two young women, you're just gonna die.
Yeah, to a certain extent, it feels like the video game. There is something that I found sort of specifically different about this sequence. Like in the game, it starts out as a much more intimate sequence where like you're in the subway room, there's like three wolves, and you know, the same red lighting, which I love. And there's like the three wolves, they're looking around, you can hear them, and you can hear around you clickers, and they're moving in like these adjacent rooms. And there's only a couple of them at first, there's like four or five of them. And so what you can do, you know, is if you have a bottle or a brick, is you can throw it and the clickers hear it and come running into the room. And that encounter where it's like four or five clickers, three wolves, and then the two of you is sort of the initial encounter. And then once you get out of that room and you're like trying to escape the subway station, the horde eventually comes for you and you have to just run because you can't. And I think this is a function of needing to be a television show with a big action sequence, right? Where it immediately jumps off as a huge horde shows up. You can't. I kind of would have liked it better if they would have had a slightly more intimate moment with some like really gnarly clickers and like them hiding behind a box while a clicker just like takes out one of the wolves. But I think maybe that's just adding too much to the sequence and adding a couple of minutes of runtime to the episode that they wouldn't want, or budgetary restrictions. You never know. But like for the TV show, it makes sense, I guess, for them to use that visual reference that they've constantly come back to, something that's not really in the game, which is like the cordyceps in the ground being able to signal to the infected elsewhere and draw them in. Right. That's a recurring thing. And have it sort of turn into this big sequence. Cause I actually really like the, when they're going through the subway car, I love the sound design of when they're going through like the connector piece of the, and you can hear them like pounding on the rubber.
Pushed, it's getting pushed in from the pressure on the sides.
That's super cool.
That does look really cool.
So I think ultimately it still works. It's just, I kind of miss that initial setup of like Ellie and Dina just sort of hiding out and letting the clickers do their dirty work for them initially. But, you know, I think it still works. And ultimately, I think the big difference here is that in the game, there are spores. And in the game, Dina and Ellie are wearing masks. And that, I think, I can see why they made this change. Because having Ellie get bit makes a little bit more sense, because then you can have this slightly longer confrontation afterward where they have to like wait overnight to see if Ellie turns. Because the way it works in the game, at least, is if you breathe in spores, you become infected or basically poisoned by them very quickly, and it goes very wrong very quickly for you. And it's, I think, that's why in the game you don't have to have this protracted argument with Dina as to why Ellie, as to whether or not she believes Ellie is immune. So I kind of like it, you know, and also, you know, not having your protagonist characters wearing gas masks through the main action sequence of your episode is probably better. As far as HBO executives are concerned, they like to see actors' faces for the most part. And and I think it still works pretty well. It's still a very thrilling sequence. It still plays out in about the same way. It still accomplishes the same goal, which is ultimately Ellie gets bit and then she has to reveal her secret to Dina. And I love the dramatic tension that creates. And I think it's extremely well acted between our two actors here.
I love the set they have for it, too, where it is an expansive set, but we stay in pretty close on them for the most part once they've sort of spilled their secrets to each other. But like the series of shots where she wakes or where they wake up, Ellie wakes up from the raindrops on her head, and Dina still has the gun trained on them, but we only see sort of the gun because the flashlight's blocking her face. And it isn't until like her face is sort of revealed that we realize that like she's dealing with the fact that she's realized she's secretly pregnant because she's peed on all these sticks. And again, really works for me, because it seems like these people's lives are just like a roller coaster of intensely heightened situations. None of them really seem to have come up with like really great coping mechanisms. So the whole, we just survived a horde in the subway and, you know, had so much more to fight for, we didn't even know about either through immunity or pregnancy, really works for me.
Sure.
Visually, as well as storytelling
like,
wise.
Where's that giant brick of weed that Ellie took from Gene's stash? Like, bust that thing out.
The time.
This is a stressful time. but yeah, I think it works. It works extremely well. I like the sort of rearranging of all of these moments to then ultimately bring them to the point where they realize that they want to be together. And
so now that they are together, what did we miss out on in the grow house for our commies? Because that seems to have been a conversation that we're not going to get.
I mean,
have we moved beyond it?
It's a very similar thing, right? Like so in the game, instead of Jesse and Ellie being together while Joel is meeting Abby in the snowstorm, it's Ellie and Dina, and they find the weed. They actually smoke some weed and they hook up, and they sort of realize at that point that they're into each other. And this is long before Dina knows that she's pregnant. This is long before, obviously, before Joel dies. And I think that, you know, it felt consequential a few episodes ago, right? It was like, well, why aren't they doing it? But seeing the choice to move it to this significantly more tense moment and allow their realization that they're into each other to be this release after they've put, you know, truth out into the open on both sides, right? You know, Dina's admitting that she's pregnant. Ellie is admitting that she's immune. I think works a little bit better from a TV standpoint, right? We don't need to rush to get those two together. And I don't necessarily think there's anything more to that conversation that we're not getting. So I think, they're not skipping it. And also, I mean, Ellie still has that brick of weed, so they could still.
That was a problem I always had in screenwriting school, is there are times in a story where a character kind of needs to stop keeping a secret. And you always have to, like, sort of figure out the incident that's going to make that possible. Mm-hmm. Intoxication, super easy. So I get smoking a joint in a post-weed society where that's going to hit you pretty hard. But I also like, just escaped a subway station full of zombies. That also seems like a confessable time period for me. So I'm into it.
Yep.
It works. I'm just sad that when people don't like something about a show, their reaction is sometimes it's a bad show. I think shows can have lots of good and bad.
Sure.
You got to kind of figure out if something bothers you. I think it's a lot more useful to figure out exactly why it bothers you than just be like, the show's bad. But I assume if our listeners are still with us at this point, that they're keeping up with the show, or at least not having a horrible time to the point that they still want to hear two dudes talk about it Wednesday after it airs.
Well, and I think, I think it's important to realize that as an adaptation, there are going to be significant differences. And I think there's opportunity there, right? Like, I'm personally very excited to learn more about Isaac and the WLF, that it seems like we're going to spend more time with them. I'm also very excited to see them actually building sets. You know, the subway set is something they built. The TV station is something they were able to build. So, like, to bring these things to life from the video game, I think that's really great. So, you know, you got to take the story changes with that, because there are limitations to what they can do on television. And there's also larger, you know, the butterfly effect of adaptation, as George R. R. Martin likes to remind us. There are other story changes down the road that they may be setting up that we will be able to judge when it's all said and done. And, you know, ultimately, these are going to be two completely different versions of the same story. And the video game's still there. If you really want to go back and enjoy the scene where they smoke weed and are having a good time while Joel is getting captured and murdered, you can still go experience that one over and over and over again if you want. I wouldn't recommend it. It's not a healthy thing, but still very much there. Dave, a very important side question related to the next morning. They wake up. Obviously, there's a morning breath joke. But then their solution to this, and this is actually something that I think not enough post-apocalyptic fiction deals with, which is the fact that everyone probably stinks.
Right.
But do you think beef jerky would make post-apocalyptic morning breath better or worse? I'm going to go with worse.
I mean, I think the reality is worse, but I do think tasting the same as the person you're going to kiss in the morning is ultimately better than just two separate morning breaths.
Okay. So we approve of the strategy in general. It's just, going to taste good either way.
It's not going to taste good either way, but the sort of like personalized plaque buildup mouth rot smell that everybody gets just naturally by being human and having warm, moist mouths, just cover it up with something that's the same as whoever you're kissing. Sure. That's, I think, the important part.
It does bring into question whether or not toothpaste still exists in this world. Because at first I was like, is she going to pull toothpaste out of her backpack? That would be amazing.
I mean, maybe toothpaste is a commodity in this world. But if you have, like, I don't know, 5 working pregnancy tests, I imagine there are toothpastes somewhere.
Probably in Jackson, but I doubt they have any on the road here.
Oh, yeah, probably not on the road. Or maybe there is some in, like, a Seattle store that has just been sitting. I mean, if there's a full-ass guitar with the silica bag still in it, I'm sure there's toothpaste somewhere. The last unopened toothpaste tube.
I suppose it is one of those things that doesn't really expire, right? Like, toothpaste doesn't, as far as I know, doesn't go bad. So it could be sitting on a shelf for 20 years. No,
it'll, like, dry out. But, I think if it's sealed, it'll be fine.
Okay.
Who knew that was where we are maybe ending the calm? Anything else before I move into the storm, Neil?
I think that is about all I have. I love a good shout out to Ellie's Apollo 1 knowledge. Very, very important. Her love of space. This is one of my favorite Ellie things, is Ellie's love of space that has now been referenced multiple times since season 1. So. Just putting a pin.
Surely that's not going anywhere.
Putting a pin in that for later.
Well, if you are a call me, feel free to jump off now. We'll be back next week talking about episode 5 of season 2. But for the rest of you who are undaunted by spoilers or just curious what might happen next, follow me into the storm.
Buy now and make no payments until fall. That's right. At Jeff Weiler's Columbus Auto Mall, drive today with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. Whether it's a car, truck, or SUV, why wait? Shop hundreds of vehicles, all with no payments till fall. Hurry into the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall, where the deals won't wait and neither should you. Find us on Gender Road or JeffWeilerColumbusAutoMall.com.
First storm and the last.
We're back, Neil. We have our usual teaser and promo images. It looks like spores, though, on the menu.
Oh, yeah. Well, and it's funny because this, I can now anticipate the adaptation choice here, which is like, why didn't they do the gas masks and the spore stuff in this week's episode in the subway station? But I know why they're holding it for next week. And I knew immediately when I saw Nora in the teaser, because Nora, things go very poorly for her with relation to her breathing in some spores. And I think that I'm very excited to see if they go through with it. I mean, Ellie has a confrontation with her that I think is pretty gnarly and is, I think, going to maybe solve some of those concerns that we talked about that folks are having. It was like, Ellie's not angry enough. It's like, I don't know, man, wait till you see what she does to Nora and Nora's face. But it also involves the breathing in of spores and what that does to you and how quickly that happens. And I think that's pretty cool. Now, the bigger question here, though, is obviously we see in the teaser the basement of the hospital, which is important for 2 reasons, Dave. One, obviously the spores. And the question is, like, are they going to introduce shamblers? Because shamblers are a part. I think you meet your first shambler in the game before you get to the hospital, but it's around the same time. And obviously shamblers are similar to bloaters. They're larger infected that expel spores. So now once we get spores, we can get into the not just the spores that come from, as we see in this teaser, infected that are like attached to a wall, expelling spores, but like the ones that run around and just like blow up spores. That'll be fun. Hopefully. I assume we're going to get that. But there's this one line in the trailer where I believe it's the person that Hanrahan is talking to, who seems to be like a squadron leader, and she talks about sending a whole squad down to the basement of the hospital and that the whole floor was empty, not even rats. Rats. Interesting
rat
specific thing to call out there, Dave, because guess who lives in the basement of that fucking hospital?
The rat king?
Your guy, the rat king.
Yeah.
Now, I would not expect that we're going to see the rat king yet, because the rat king is not part of this part of the story. The rat king is an Abby storyline thing. Abby's the one who encounters the rat king in the basement of, and actually she encounters the rat king before Ellie gets to the hospital, like the way it actually works, timeline wise, but we don't see it until much later in the game. But it would be very fun if they like set it up a little bit, potentially that there is like something bigger and scarier down there, even if they don't show it.
Well, have we already gotten to the crossover point? So like, is the explosion that we see at the end of this week's episode, are we going to see what happens next season from Abby's perspective? Like, are we already overlapping? Because we're in day one, right?
Maybe. It's either that or that explosion could be related to Jesse being in Seattle. Because there's an explosion that Ellie goes and investigates. That's where she finds Jesse. Because like he shows up and gets sort of besieged by a squadron of wolves, and he sets off a huge explosion. So that could be that. But yeah, the crossover, there is a crossover point where Abby's in the hospital. She's down in the basement. She encounters the Rat King, among other things. And then it's like the not long after that, Ellie shows up in the hospital, finds Nora, and they end up in the basement of the hospital and with the spores and whatnot. So and it is what's interesting about this is that the Ellie getting to Nora, if she gets to Nora in the next episode, that is a more advanced part of Ellie's story than I thought we would get to this quickly in the season, because Nora is the one that gives up Abby's location. Nora is the one that's like, she's at the aquarium. And that's how Ellie,
after being beaten to death with the pipe, I believe.
Yeah, after Ellie beats her a lot. And so like Nora is ultimately the one, like there are several other incidents. Well, I guess we saw the TV station one. There's one of Abby's friends is at the TV station already dead in the game, which we didn't see in the show, but she could have been there for all we know.
Well, didn't they say very specifically none of like they had Dina have a line in the station, like none of these are from Abby's
none of the people that are and that's true in the game too. None of the people hanging. She's like in a back office. You find her. No. But that's fine. I also think that maybe there's fewer people from Abby's group in the show. Like maybe there aren't quite as many, but either way, we're getting to Nora a little bit faster than I thought we would. And so that sort of throws off what I'm thinking pacing wise. And I'm back to now thinking that we could get the confrontation of Ellie and Abby in the theater as the cliffhanger to end the season, which again would be bold, borderline psychotic for a television show to end like that. But especially because we have not seen any more Abby stuff, it does seem like we could bowl right through Ellie's story, get our flashbacks out of the way, our Joel flashbacks here in this season, and then end in a spot where we're going to pick up next season with doubling back to day one from Abby's perspective. And I think that's really, really interesting, especially because like in the next time on for episode 5, we also see there's like the scars hanging somebody in the woods. And that is sort of a key setup for an Abby scene that comes later in her storyline. And I think that they're doing a lot more of the setup on the Ellie side than I thought they would for what eventually becomes the Abby perspective. So they might be doing it. I didn't think they would.
I mean, I'm excited if they do it, only because that means season 3 has like a much more protracted lift, I feel, but also has enough story, I think, to cover.
Oh, sure.
Where you could like do a good 4 episodes in season 3 and then you know, take a little break before the big climax of the game. I don't know why I'm being cagey about it. Then we're in the storm.
Craig Mazin also says something really interesting sort of along these lines on the official podcast, where he's like, now that we're renewed for season three, speaking of Isaac, he's like, in the game, you don't get a lot of like what Isaac wants, right? You don't dig into his motivation very deeply. You don't spend a lot of time with him at all. But he's like, because especially now that we've been renewed for season three, we will absolutely find out what he wants, which I was like, oh, so Isaac is going to be around, which was a theory that we had talked about in the storm, I think last week or the week before, where it's like, if you're going to pay for a Jeffrey Wright, you want to get your money's worth on Jeffrey Wright,
right,
especially now that you've had to kill off Pedro Pascal. So I think that I'm more sure that like the big action sequence on the Seraphite Island is going to be like an early season three thing. I'm feeling even more sure that the Abby storyline is going to be more heavily put into season three. And I think that is, again, it will be a very wild choice for the TV show to end where Ellie's story in the game in Seattle ends, which is like Abby shows up in the theater. She does some violent shit, right? She like shoots Jesse. She's basically about to shoot Ellie, and then it just cuts and that's it. And then you have to go back in time to her perspective and learn how she got to the theater in the first place. And it's wild. It also means, again, that we get to the end of this season and we're not going to feel very good about Ellie. But she's going to do some horrible, horrible stuff starting next week with what she does to Nora. So I think that'll answer anybody who thinks that she's not angry enough. That'll answer that. Right. And you know, narratively, from a tension standpoint, it creates this push-pull between, now she's going to have this reason to leave, right? This reason to take Dina out of here. And she's only going to continue to be stubbornly resist that and go down a much darker path in not giving up the whole quest to go get Abby, which is pretty wild. So I'm excited about
it. I mean, that seems like it is possible. It does make me wonder, as somebody who has been continually saying we're going to get a full flashback episode, that kind of needs to be six, I think. I don't think there's any way that we end the season on a flashback episode. I think people would revolt.
Sure.
There's too much difference from what we were trying to get done this season versus what we actually get done this season. So, but I do think we have a lot of stuff to sort of like clear up, both from the past and in Jackson. And I do feel like this season is it's very, very possible that it's going to end with a flashback to the porch. But the only reason I've been saying that is I just assume you just shoot all the Pedro Pascal stuff the season you have Pedro Pascal,
right,
and don't have to pay him or schedule him for a season three. But who knows? Maybe I'm wrong with that. Maybe season three does have more Pedro Pascal than I was expecting. If they're gonna, save a whole bunch of stuff.
I think it's possible. I mean, I also think it's possible that they have stuff that they shot for this season that they could use for season three with Pedro in it. Flashback stuff, right? If they shot a bunch more stuff in those Jackson sets, right? Like It does seem kind of curious that they built the whole interior of Joel's house just for that one scene. That is kind of weird.
They built a whole subway set for this one scene.
That's true. That's true. It is HBO's money. Spend it, I say. But I also do think that it is interesting. Where was I going to go with this? Another potentially interesting thing. I want to jump to an email that we got from Faye.
Yeah.
About potentially when Abby comes back. So we do think Abby's going to come back, right? At some point.
Yes.
Yes. Oh, sorry. I had one more point that I wanted to make about flashbacks. So either we're going to get a flashback episode, and I agree with you, it would have to be episode 6, or they're going to pepper in the flashbacks over the next 3 episodes, and they're just not putting them in the teasers. Right? Like, that's going to...
Fair.
That seems, you know, similar to the way when they promoted the episode where Joel dies, we got almost none of the stuff in the snowstorm in the promotional materials. So I still think that's possible. I don't know how you do an entire flashback episode and sort of maintain any level of sort of secrecy about that, right? Like, if you like, what is the next time on next week if episode 6 is a flashback episode, right? Like, I guess it's a preview of the flashbacks, but then, I mean, then the spoilers will run rampant on social media like crazy, because it's a direct scene from the game.
I think it
would be better from a marketing standpoint for them to sneak those flashbacks into the next couple episodes. But we'll see what they do.
We have seen one shot of Abby's eye opening that they made it look like was going to be an episode, I think 3 or whatever, that we haven't seen promoed or in the show yet. So to answer your devil's advocate question, how do you promo an episode that's a flashback episode with just the Abby parts of it is how I would do it.
Yeah, maybe.
So we think, oh, we're going to go catch up with Abby. It's been a while for Abby, but no, she's just like, actually, this is the time for the Phelan email.
Yeah. Okay. And this was a really good email from Phelan who put forward this theory. And it's funny because I had a similar realization last night when I was streaming. We're recording this on Tuesday. So this past Monday, when I was streaming the game and I was playing through Abby's storyline, and there's a moment that you get to where they explain how Abby knew that Joel was in Jackson, like how they knew to go to Jackson in the first place.
Oh, yeah. Interesting. I never thought about that, but of course.
And so the way it's explained is that Abby found out that Tommy was in Jackson. Like, they found out that Tommy Miller was part of the Jackson community, and she connected the dots through like some of their old Firefly contacts. And I opened up our email today and I got an email from Phelan, who basically lays out a theory, similar theory, where it's like, what if the reason why Gene had to die, we're back to Gene theories, is that Gene was involved in, somehow spreading the information about Jackson, maybe that's not necessarily why Gene would have to die, right? Because obviously Joel doesn't know that Abby is coming until the moment she gets there. But maybe there's something about Gene passing off information, right? Or being a little loose-lipped about the Jackson community that ultimately is the reason why Gene had to be put down, I guess. Mm-hmm. And I kind of like this theory. Like, that we learn somehow roundabouts that Gene was ultimately responsible for Abby and the WLF learning that Joel was in Jackson. And
because he was a Firefly,
he was a Firefly.
Firefly tag.
And he's the reason Dina knew what the WLF's patch was, right? Because he had talked to her about them. So I think that if, you know, maybe Gene unknowingly gave out that information that Tommy was there, and that's how Abby put two and two together, and that's ultimately what led her to Jackson. So we're gonna add that for now. Tentatively, we may be able to add that to the list of Gene's crimes.
Well, we have that, and then we have the theory that I also like, that they're gonna put him down because he got bit, but like maybe Joel lets him get bit,
sure,
sort of as like a convenience,
or maybe that's just the official story, is he got bit and,
yeah,
you know, he got killed for a different reason.
Gotta do that. We gotta figure out whatever Gail's talking about with the moth in the season-long teaser. We've got some more stuff to do in Jackson.
For sure.
I am still hoping for a flashback episode, but
yeah, well, and
we haven't gotten the visit to the Natural History Museum. We haven't gotten the space flashback. So
the show also still needs to deal with the other two characters in the game who come to Seattle. Right.
Also that. So yes. Like,
the explosion, I think, could be Jesse. Jesse definitely ends up in Seattle. Does not make it back to Jackson. And I'm very curious to see what's going to happen with Tommy. Is Tommy going to follow Ellie and Dina? Like, because it is pretty important, I would say, for like the final. I don't want to call it the final act, but yeah, like the final 20% of this story, Ellie's final push, where she decides that she's going to actually go back out and like leave again to finish the deal and go find Abby, is very wrapped up in a conversation that she has with Tommy. And Tommy is sort of the one who pushes her toward finishing it after all this horrible shit has happened in Seattle. And Ellie sort of eventually realizes that maybe she should give up and stop this cycle of violence. You know, the reason why she ends up not doing that necessarily is because of Tommy. So I think that to me feels, you know, like a foundational element of the end of the story. And you can't have that unless he goes to Seattle. And you can't do it. You can't substitute Jesse in there unless you don't kill Jesse. And if you don't kill Jesse, then Jesse's around later in the story. And they have this, you know, this weird family unit, I guess, that sort of throws off the dynamic between Ellie and Dina. So, yeah, I'm very curious to see where Tommy pops up again. So who knows? Maybe. I think it's possible, I guess, that maybe even as early as next week, Tommy and Jesse, they encounter both of them and they've come to, you know, rescue. Because I guess you could see it even from like a TV logic standpoint, where it's like Tommy feels like he has to protect Ellie. So he's going to come to Seattle. Jesse, who has recently hooked up with Dina recently enough to get her pregnant, feels like he has to rescue Dina. And so now they've come together to bring them back from Seattle. So
maybe that's what that explosion was. Yeah. I'm going to guess that you're right about that. We got, of course, a couple of promo images from season 2, episode 5. And there's one with sort of like Dina looking at someone sort of like quizzically, and Ellie's behind her looking at like the back of Dina's head
in the daytime.
That's the face you make if Jesse shows up. Mm-hmm. That's the face you make if Jesse shows up and you just realize you're pregnant. So I'm going to guess that's what like that moment could be, because it's not the WLF. It's not the scars. One or both of them would be more angry or afraid. This is a sort of puzzlingly inquisitive look.
And I do think that it's important that we get Jesse showing up next week, potentially, because, right, like at the end of this episode, Dina is like, I'll go with you to Ellie, right? I'll go out there with you. We're doing this together. That is not how it goes down in the hospital. And it's actually very important that Dina is not there when the spore shit happens, right? Because Dina will not survive a basement full of spores. Ellie will. And so like it's ultimately important that Ellie ends up going to find Nora by herself. So, and it isn't until Jesse shows up that Jesse is like, oh no, I don't even know if he knows that she's pregnant, but like at that point, Dina's like sick. So Jesse's like, no, you have to stay here. And, you know, and I think Jesse's also injured from the encounter with the bomb. So like they stay at the theater and Ellie goes to the hospital and has the interaction with Nora. And that's, you know, also seems pretty key to giving Ellie the space to unlock her darkest impulses on Nora's face.
Into it, can't wait. I thought that's where we would end the season, but I guess not. I do think that's where we have to end the episode, though. Mm-hmm. So maybe we have enough room for some flashbackiness one way or the other.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, now that Ellie's thinking about becoming a dad, maybe she'll think about Joel.
Yeah, And also, what a great time to remind us about Jesse, if Jesse's going to show up. It's all coming together. Neil, you, as you said in your playthrough, have gotten to the Abby part. I was correct in the column when I say we have gotten through where Shimmer was supposed to die.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
All right. Shimmer. So Shimmer might just live in Seattle now.
Unless they're moving it to somewhere else. Yeah, I mean, it's right before they get to the TV station. They get Shimmer walks over a landmine. They get captured by Ellie gets captured by some wolves, and Dina has to go rescue her. And then they go to the TV station. So I don't know. Maybe Shimmer lives or dies off screen.
Or that's next week.
You know what? I think it would be wild if Shimmer made it all the way back to Jackson. That would be awesome. Good for Shimmer.
What a adaptation choice,
right?
To let Shimmer live rather than have it step on a landmine.
I mean, I kind of don't like it because then it gives me hope for another animal character later, Alice. But I don't want to have to go through. That's an even more intense emotional journey because Alice is a dog. But
oh yeah,
you know, we'll see. I don't know if the show can avoid that one quite like the Shimmer thing.
Well, you hate to see it, yep. But it is good to be in the middle of another season of The Last of Us and all the moral ambiguity that brings with it. Is there any final predictions you want to make, Neil, before we let our people go?
I just hope we see a Shambler this week. I hope that's a surprise, right? Because I think putting the spores stuff in the promo is one thing, but I think putting a next level infected in, and I don't think it's the Rat King. The Rat King is a season 3 boss. I think a Shambler would be really fun, and
I think having the spore exhaled like we do in the teaser is a good first step to just a Shambler coming around the corner, just being like, bleh.
Yeah, exactly.
I think that'd do it. Yep. I'm down for it.
Let's go Shamblers.
Shamblers on deck, Rat King next season. Tune in to see if we are right by watching The Last of Us on HBO on Sundays, and then listen to us next Wednesday as we continue The Last of Us season 2 with episode 5. Until then, be excellent to each other.
Buy now and make no payments until fall. That's right. At Jeff Weiler's Columbus Auto Mall, drive today with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. Whether it's a car, truck, or SUV, why wait? Shop hundreds of vehicles, all with no payments till fall. Hurry into the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall, where the deals won't wait and neither should you. Find us on Gender Road or jeffweilercolumbusautomall.com.